This is the Saxo Market Call, daily insights on what is moving the financial markets.
Hello and welcome to the Saxo Market Call. It is Friday, 25th of March, 2022. And we talked about markets reaching key resistance levels for at least the U.S. market. We're basically at those levels, whether it's the 100-day moving average or the 61.8% retracement we've talked about on the June future. It's a little bit further away if you're looking at the cash index, the key 61.8%, but we're basically in the zone. We can't go down to the single point levels on this anyway. You can see it on slide two, the June S&P future we put up there, 4530 area. And I think just the general backdrop, one of watching, a game of chicken, if you will, a dangerous game we called it earlier this week, as the Fed has yet to catch up and impress in terms of its constant ratcheting higher of hawkish expectations. This rally was launched, after all, in the wake of that March 16th FOMC meeting. We've seen even more hawkishness coming out since then, new highs in rates all along the yield curve, and it so far has not impressed this market. And we think the Fed is, to some degree, explicitly targeting financial conditions, and we'll be talking more about that. But it just feels very pivotal here. We also have, as you mentioned yesterday, Peter, end of quarter coming up, potentially some rebalancing in portfolios as well. We've seen there was an article out in FT yesterday talking about the worst drawdown from the highs in bond funds in the history of bond funds going back to 1990. And it's been absolutely a brutal quarter here. What's your take on what you saw yesterday? And I'll shut up now since my intro is about to be this whole podcast.
It's actually okay, because it just reminded me when you said that with the asset location, my very, very old, she's 95 years old, grandmother. I actually take care of her in her investments, and she has a very simple asset allocation, and that's a very simple portfolio with some ETFs and stocks and bonds. And I only rarely rebalance it, but then of course the weights drift in that portfolio. And I actually looked at it yesterday because we have to do tax in Denmark. And to your point, John, I looked at the weights, and the weights in the bond fund were had dropped way below the weight bands I've set for rebalancing. So that is something I have to do very shortly. So to the point that a lot of asset allocations,
there are real impacts.
There will be real bias coming into this market, and it's buying that is not looking at the yield on the inflation. It's just simply mechanical, the way you want the portfolio to look like according to some risk measures. So I can really, I've seen it with my own eyes last night at on the computer. Anyway, slide two as well, in terms of the theme baskets, I think the semiconductors was a pleasant positive surprise yesterday, up 3.3%. Otherwise, it was a very, not very entirely inspiring, not any firm direction. But I want to sort of put the attention towards slide three. So I think we had two macro indicators yesterday. So we had the preliminary PMI figures for March in Europe, which were better than expected and comfortably above 50 yesterday, both in France and Germany. I thought it was pretty odd. You had the ZEW survey last week, which is a survey among economists in Europe, and that was they had the bleakest outlook or expectations for the economy in three decades. And here we are with the companies still flying at a high speed. And then later into the session, we had the U.S. initial jobless claims, which hit, at least in nominal terms, the lowest levels on record since 1967. And I've plotted here on slide three the four-week average initial jobless claims and scaled it with the size of employment in the U.S. So you have a much more stable ratio, so you can compare it over time. And we have hit the second lowest on this ratio. There's just 1 week before the pandemic started that printed a lower ratio than what we're seeing right now. And we will push into new record territory on this one. And it just underscored the enormous pressure there is in the US labor market and the economy. And that leads me, and I want you to pull you into the discussion, John, because this is a point I've been trying to make also on the podcast over the past at least a year. I had some charts at one point with inflation, and I had my comment is basically, every time we've had an FOMC meeting, they have updated or increased their inflation outlook every single time from their previous forecast. And I said, it suggested you have some econometric models behind the Fed that are not able to capture the inflation dynamics. And the Fed has turned extremely model, have become very model driven over the past 20 years with a lot of PhDs in math and economics coming into the Fed. And Anna Wong, the U.S. You know, chief economist for the U.S. economy at Bloomberg, she's worked at the Fed, by the way. She said that there is the past year, the FOMC's confidence has been undermined as their models and forecasts have not been able to come true, and they're not capturing these dynamics. And the point being here that the Fed is scrambling to understand, and human intuition and judgment will come much more into play in the coming FOMC meetings. And I think it personally leads to more volatility, more uncertainty and policy mistakes. But where are you on in this debate,
well,
John?
That's really interesting because we have, of course, seen this tremendous change in direction towards the hawkish from the Fed. But there's nonetheless this weird note of caution every time. They almost seem to want to have everything priced in before they do it. So there was a big adjustment that had to take place, and it was around November of last year, these acceptance speeches for the renomination of Powell and Brainard. But it just seems like they have to come out and get it priced in before they actually sort of fulfill the expectations. If this Fed wants to get ahead of the curve, they need to really surprise the market, make it feel like anything is possible. Instead, they've missed a couple of chances. They lifted off only by 25 basis points. Prior to that, they didn't just end the quantitative easing. They let it dribble all the way into this month before doing so. So it just, to me, it's a long wait until that May 4th FOMC meeting. And talking about the markets and where they are, if we don't pivot lower here, if we continue, especially if we just rush back higher, let's say we get some decent news that sees the oil prices lower, a bit of ebullience there, what have you, or regardless, we just continue higher and in terms of financial conditions and the equity market, I think the Fed is going to have to do something and do something big and something maybe like an intermediate 50 basis point move or set the bar even higher. It is a dangerous game. And I think at some point the Fed does get ahead of the curve, but it's just a very difficult process for them to feel out. In addition to what you're talking about, which is the mechanics of that they haven't been able to predict any of this, this backdrop anyway. And so speaking of financial conditions, I want to jump to slide 5 because I put up a couple of things just here for perspective. I mean, we are seeing financial conditions tightening in a lot of meaningful ways, but it's tightening on, you know, into a, what has been galloping rises, for example, in home prices. So that mortgage rate up at 4.5% plus, getting towards the highs really since, let's call it 2011 by that metric. And what does that mean in real terms? Well, it means if you're taking out a mortgage for the same size now relative to when they were at their lows, it's about a 30% higher payment, and prices have gone up 20% at a 20% clip. So you're paying a heck of a lot more for, let's call it a $300,000, whatever the size of the mortgage is, than you were just a year ago. So that's a meaningful tightening. Of course, that only tightens on those taking out new mortgages. So that's only the new mortgage market. But then you have the other measures here on slide 5. That was the black line, the mortgage level. The financial conditions from the Chicago Fed. This is the one the Fed likes to use, apparently. There's a bit of smoothness there because it looks like it's done on an averaging basis. But you can see we're getting above, that's the blue line, we're getting above those levels from late 2018, which really by this measure didn't look that relevant anyway, but the market was falling apart back then. So that's kind of interesting. They were even tighter still in late 2015. I think that's some linkage into the huge correction in oil and energy related names. There was a big wipeout there because of the collapse in oil prices. And then on the high yield credit, we're still at very low levels. Yes, we've seen a tick up, but we're nowhere near even those 2018 levels.
No, exactly. I read as well, John, yesterday on Twitter. It was a small comment from Macro Alf, which is a former fixed income portfolio manager that is making a lot of macro commentaries on Twitter. And he made this calculation of the mortgage rate where he compared the monthly payments on a median house based on the median house price in the US from a year ago and today. And then he compared with the current median rent price in the US. And what was interesting about that is that right now the current mortgage rate actually puts the payments on a house you own above the current rent price. So either you'll begin to see demand destruction or the economy is strong enough and rents will be pushed higher. And I think the difference right now was $200 per month. And if it's the latter, so the economy is strong enough that, you know, rent prices will push towards that equilibrium you get from the mortgage rate, then you have another boost into the CPI basket. Because if I'm correct, I think is it a quarter or a third of the CPI basket that is coming from rent?
I'm sure it's quite high. And there's also that lag effect. So these new home prices, again, rising at a 20% clip, we are starting to see the rent prices catch up. And there's discussions of enormous upward adjustments in new new contracts there. So, a very interesting picture. And at what point does it get ahead of what is a very a positive output gap in a very tight economy? All right, let's actually want to rewind back a little bit, just to one slide, to the FX. The big headline stealer, the big development in FX, has been the weaker Japanese yen. And to what degree we can risk this becoming a massive carry trade. Historically, Japanese, especially retail traders, but investors in general, can drive enormous moves in FX in the markets if they catch a hold of a theme and an investment narrative. As long as global yields are rising, any further rise in yields transmits straight into the Japanese yen, as long as the Bank of Japan doubles down that yield cap on the 10-year JGB. Overnight, we saw considerable volatility because the Bank of Japan Governor Kuroda was out with a very big mishmash of things to say. First of all, sort of doubling down on the commitment to existing policy, but claiming that they are watching FX closely. And then the Ministry of Finance even chiming in that it does not think that rapid moves are desirable. So because I guess plenty of people have gotten along this theme, dollar, yen, et cetera, we saw considerable two-way volatility. But some of that has come back out because we are seeing yields very close to the highs for the cycle. So again, though, end of quarter, potential for yields to drop a bit on some mechanical rebalancing, but it's also end of Japanese financial year. It is an extremely stretched move, but if yields continue to rise, there will continue to be pressure. And the theme is very powerful if you get a big capital flow angle to this as investors catch on to this theme. After all, let's look at it from a Japanese investor's point of view. You can get higher yield elsewhere and your own currency is collapsing. The levels of Japanese savings are legendary. I remember one point, this is some years back, I don't know what the current level is, their Japanese savings were worth 100% of US GDP. A bag of change there that can be thrown around for even on the level of global capital flows.
I get all the dynamics you talked about there, and especially the carry trade, but maybe it's because I'm just a stupid equity guy and doesn't really understand currencies. But I would argue that longer term, John, you know, the inflation differential is definitely positive if it's the inflation, the US minus Japan, and that in theory should lead to a weaker dollar versus the yen over time. Or am I totally wrong on that?
You're totally right in terms of real rates. If the US, if the US currency is becoming less valued because there's higher inflation relative to the return you get on the currency, yes, that's a fundamental problem there. But there are other dynamics at work. And especially in the case of Japan, where you have a upside down demographics, maybe the wage earners don't have the negotiating power. And on domestically, apparently there's no ability for sort of wages to track higher. They're talking also about actually coming in and subsidizing. This is the theme everywhere, subsidizing lower income households in terms of rising energy costs. So the potential is for those inflation levels to look lower than they actually are, if that's being transmitted to a worsening Japanese balance sheet. But we have to watch all these dynamics. But again, I think the tendency will be if yields continue to rise, for this move to continue to play out, even though, as you mentioned, Peter, in fundamental real effective terms, the Japanese currency is essentially at record low levels. I think if you go back far enough, there were some lower levels back in the sort of mists of time. But in terms of modern history, this is the weakest Japanese yen on a real effective basis we've seen. And then other themes, of course, the ongoing commodity focus, the Australian dollar doing quite well, dollar sort of middle of the pack. And again, if we get a decent sell-off and adjustment of risk sentiment, I'm very curious to see how the dollar behaves around that. Okay, and speaking of which, we're going into another weekend. We have a hot war in Ukraine. We have Biden in Europe. These speeches, the geopolitical backdrop remains very nervous. And I've been quite stunned, actually, the degree to which the market is essentially thumbing its nose at all of these risks. Biden out warning yesterday again on the Chinese involvement in helping Russia's economy. There was an article in Bloomberg as well about European leaders concerned that China could be helping Russia, not in military terms, but in terms of supplying those key bits and pieces that make life really difficult for the Russian economy, things like semiconductors, et cetera. So the Chinese position becoming very difficult, I think, and maintaining its sort of neutral attempt at a neutral stance here as the situation continues to unfold and this so-called risk of vertical escalation. If Russia's bogged down efforts deteriorate further from the Russian point of view, does Putin reach for weapons of mass destruction? There's been a lot of drumbeats of warning from the U.S. side on that. But that terrible issue aside, Peter, there's plenty going on. it looks like still mostly an Asian focus as we look at today and the week ahead.
In very, Chinese focus still. We're just coming out of the week with a lot of Chinese technology and consumer names. And we have Mei Twin still waiting for that report to come out. It will be after the Hong Kong close. Growth is expected to be 30% on the top line, but a widening loss on the operating side as cost continues to mount in a lot of Chinese industries for a lot of the same reasons that we've seen costs going up elsewhere. Next week, it is quite funny to talk about a lot of Chinese large companies and their earnings releases coming now, because I'm looking at the watch. I mean, there's only 2.5 weeks and then we'll suddenly get the U.S. first quarter earnings, and we're just getting the fourth quarter earnings from China. It's an incredible lag, and I always find it mind-boggling to think about that JP Morgan Chase, one of the largest banks in the world, are able to compile all their financial records and come out with their quarterly statement 10 days after the quarter's ended. And then you have the largest banks in China. They have to spend 3 months to get their data in order for a release. But anyway, look at the calendar next week. I've highlighted some of the names. BYD and cars on Tuesday, obviously interesting. Micron Technology is a U.S. semiconductor company we will follow on Tuesday. Lululemon Athletica, it's part of our women's leadership basket. It's one of those companies with a lot of women in the management group. And then on Wednesday, Ganfeng Lithium is one of the stocks in our battery basket, and it's a hugely important company in that industry. And Costco, China's largest container shipping company, obviously also important on Wednesday. PetroChina on Thursday, important in the oil and gas industry. So a lot to digest next week in China.
And plenty to digest as we wind towards the first of the month, which is on next Friday. And now we have the next round of U.S. employment data points. Look for that. Also look for, again, that end of quarter potential effects into Thursday next week. Interested to see as well this Conference Board Consumer Confidence Survey, which has been so mismatched relative to the Michigan survey, which is the final March version of which is out today. That one deteriorating close to the lows of the cycle back during the financial crisis. Again, there's some questions there related to purchasing and pricing that I think the inflation angle there is more impacted in the survey, or the survey is more impacted by these considerations than this more general conference board survey. And we also have the German IFO survey out today, a couple of Fed speakers, but I think next week will be interesting again, and the whole backdrop here around the Fed, the game of chicken being played by the market and the Fed, end of quarter, technical levels, what have you, whether the Fed is going to have to do something a bit bolder to surprise this market and get ahead of the curve here. So let's be careful out there and have a great weekend. And we'll be back next week with the next Saxo Market Call.
Thanks for listening. This has been the Saxo Market Call. For feedback and questions, reach out to us on Twitter @SaxoMarketCall or by email, marketcall@saxobank.com.